S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Let me in. I want to be closer to you. Open up your soul. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or when it's the first Monday of a brand new month, understand something. I have a fabulous Wonderfest science envoy here to talk about things scientific in a way that even I can understand it. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Christy Mwalem. Welcome.
Hello, hello. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. So Christy's San Francisco treat. And when did you first get bitten by the science bug?
Yeah. So I think it kind of took me a really long time before I realized science could be
fun.
Something. Yeah, fun. Because I grew up in Singapore and science was just part of like the curriculum and it was just something you had to do.
Uh-huh.
So it was like so associated with like exams that I was like, this is just something I had to get out of the way. And then it really took until I obviously had like amazing teachers, which I'm super thankful for.
Mm-hmm.
So I could, you know, digest the material, but I never thought it was ever going to be like a career option in any way.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know like regular people could be scientists. I thought that was just, I don't know how they ended up being scientists, but
okay.
I was like, maybe you were just born and then you did science.
Uh-huh.
When
did you realize that a regular person, like scientists were regular people who just liked science?
Yeah, it was definitely in college.
Uh-huh.
So I had this opportunity to, I think someone kind of almost like took a chance on me.
Uh-huh.
And I had gone to culinary school basically before I started college.
Mm-hmm.
And the PI at the time was like, it seems like a lot of the skills that you have when you're cooking could be translated to the lab.
What's a PI?
Oh, it's just like a primary investigator. So it's someone who's in charge of a lab.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wait, so cooking was done in a lab?
No, so I had gone to culinary school, and
So
I had put that on my resume that I was like, I had worked in a kitchen, and I had cooked.
Uh-huh.
And then when I started college again for biochemistry, I got introduced to basically this guy who was giving a lecture.
Uh-huh.
And he was explaining things in such a way that like even I could understand.
Uh-huh.
And so I talked to him after and I was like, this is really cool, this type of stuff that you do. Like, I don't know, is this something that, you know, you're recruiting people for? Is this something that I could do? And
uh-huh.
I've never done science before.
Uh-huh.
And I told him all of this. And he basically like took a look at me. He took a look at my resume and he was like, a lot of these skills that you learn in the kitchen like are super helpful in this. And he kind of made that connection and he was like, all right, why don't I'll take you on board. Let's do this together.
That's
which is
awesome.
Crazy though.
No, but that's awesome because me and I have friends and we've talked about how, you know, cooking on the stovetop is art, but you know, when you're baking, it's straight up chemistry. You have to measure everything to get it just right. And so it makes sense that he would see that or whoever the PI was would see that and go, yeah, this works. But why were you going back to school in biochemistry?
Yeah. So I think originally when I started college, I really wanted just the thing that I would do in the future to like help people.
Uh-huh.
And so I got really fascinated with the Doctors Without Borders.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, this seems really cool. You get to kind of like travel. You get to, you know, have your work really impact communities in a very like visible way.
Yeah.
And so I'd gone back to try to be a doctor, and that was kind of the goal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So like I'm just thinking about your folks when they're watching your trajectory. Like first it's culinary school, and then like, oh, I'm going to cook. Oh, now I'm going to be a doctor. Oh, now I'm going to be a scientist. So how did they respond to your trajectory? I mean, you are obviously on the path that you need to be, but parents don't often aren't inside your brain, so they don't necessarily know what's going on.
Yo, totally. Yeah. My parents, I will say I'm super thankful in that, like, my parents were always really supportive regardless of whatever I did. So mm-hmm. part of the reason why I even went to culinary school was because my mom noticed that I was always, like, constantly watching, like, all these cooking shows whenever I was studying. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she was like, this seems like something you're really interested in. Do you want to maybe try your hand at cooking?
Oh.
And she like was the one that gave me that push, and that was how I got that experience of cooking in kitchens, and like I really enjoyed it. And then later on, my mom was like, it seems like being a chef might be really tough. Maybe you should go back to school so that you have that like safety board.
Okay.
And so it was kind of like my mom, I think, directing me into all of these avenues. And I didn't really understand, like, I think a part of me was like, Mom, make up your mind. Like, do you want me to do this or you want me to do that?
But then you chose science, right?
Yeah, okay. I ended up choosing science. All right. 'Cause it was like something that I knew a lot when I knew that you had to do something science related to be a doctor, mm-hmm. which now in retrospect I realize you could actually major in anything and still be a doctor. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of what I gravitated towards, just because like all of my education was also like very STEM related. But I think college was the first time that I realized like science could be fun and it wasn't just something like you studied mm-hmm. just for the sake of it.
Okay, so so you start out with science just kind of being a drag that you have to get through.
Yeah.
You go to this lecture and this person explains, what were they, do you even remember what they were explaining?
I think it was something related to, so he studied like Alzheimer's and he was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so he did a lot of things related to like protein folding and unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even remember what the topic was, but I just remember kind of I remember just understanding what he said
mm-hmm.
and being like, this seems really cool. Because sometimes you go to scientific lectures and
it goes right over your head.
Yeah. And a part of you is like, maybe I'm not smart enough to understand this. Like, this mm-hmm. isn't, you know, what I was meant to do. But I think because he delivered it in a mm-hmm. way where even I could understand it, I became interested. And I was like, huh.
Yeah. I have found throughout the years that the person, it really matters, the ability of the person to teach, because anyone can understand something if you have someone who understands how to explain something in a way that sort of grabs you.
Totally.
So you go to this lecture, your PI is like, yeah, you can do this. And then what's the first thing you're doing in this new area when they take a chance on you? What's your first jobs?
Yeah, I was kind of doing a bunch of random things. So the lab was really focused on like protein crystallography, which just means like, can we figure out the structure of this protein?
Mm-hmm.
And all it was trying to do was, could you set up the conditions, like, you know, add specific things to basically like the solution so mm-hmm. that it would encourage okay. the protein to show its structure to you.
Okay.
So it was kind of just like tweaking different things and in this like solution and then trying out different things. And so I was doing really a lot of things related to that. And I was like fortunate enough, there was like, I had a mentor in that lab who I messed up so many times. I can't even tell you, but every single time I came to him and I told him I messed this up, we uh-huh. didn't get anything, he would kind of just laugh it off.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that was kind of what made it enjoyable, that I was in this process of
that,
like,
that was not punitive that you did something wrong. It was like, we're scientists, it happens all the time.
Yeah. So then it ended up being fun because then I was learning all of these things uh-huh. and I was, I think the most fascinating thing to me was that you could, through a microscope, just look at all these like itty bitty things mm-hmm. that are present in your body that mm-hmm. you just like you know, would never think about otherwise. And you could, like, you know, make all these proteins show, like, what their, like, full structure was going to be just by tweaking what solution they were in. And I think that really blew my mind that, like, you could change all these super microscopic details of this tiny thing that you can't see just by, by mixing, like, things.
This time I'm going to put a crystal of salt. This time I'm going to put a drop of iodine or is it things like that.
Yeah, just little things like that.
That's awesome.
Right? It's so crazy.
But what I also like about your experience, because a lot of people, when they think about science, they don't think about the fact that you're constantly making mistakes like a regular person.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what they say is, like, perfect is the enemy of the good. And it's also sort of the enemy of learning, because if you're not allowed to make mistakes, you don't take chances and you don't expand your repertoire. So you're doing all of this stuff. And then how do you find the branch of science that you like? How did you come across that?
Yeah, that I think that ended up taking, like, a really long time. So,
well, long time is relative. So
that's true.
What is a long time for you? Like a year, 10 years? What?
Yeah, I think it took me close to 4 years after I graduated from undergrad to actually realize this was a thing that I wanted to do. And in some ways, I'm still really trying to, like, refine what that is. Mm-hmm. Or, like, to find your passion, right, is what people like to say.
Sure.
It takes a really long time. I don't know if I found it yet. But, yeah, it was I took a lot of different paths. So after undergrad, I had a friend who was really into coding, just, like, programming.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this really great way of convincing you that if you learn how to program, it's going to be good for any field that you're interested in.
Sure, sure, sure. Like, so no matter what it is.
Exactly.
You're like modeling. Of course.
Yeah. He's like, you could do it with anything. And I made the mistake of maybe going on this long hike with him. And so throughout that entire hike, he just convinced me, you should go into programming. Great for biology. Next frontier.
Uh-huh.
And so I got really inspired by that. Then after undergrad, I decided I was going to try my hand at learning how to program.
Mm-hmm.
So that took a couple of years before I
Tired of the late nights, pulling your hair out, going, why isn't this working? Oh, I left out a semicolon.
Oh, yeah. No, that's still constant. I don't think you ever get over that.
Okay. What am I doing wrong? I'm a coder. Yeah. So I totally get it. Okay. So when did you transition from coding to plants?
Yeah. So 3 years into this job of, like, learning how to code, mm-hmm. and then I became kind of relatively comfortable, I think I was starting to really think about, like, what do I really want to do with my life?
Mm-hmm.
And this whole idea of, like, food started coming up again. Mm-hmm. So my family is originally from Indonesia. And I think food has been the forefront of, like, a lot of really my upbringing of, mm-hmm. like being able to, you know, cook different types of things. Like, so my family's Indonesian and Chinese also at the same time. So mm-hmm. it was like when I was growing up, we were mixing, like, Indonesian recipes with, like, Chinese recipes. Mm-hmm. And there were things that I was eating at home that I couldn't find anywhere else.
Okay.
And so I was trying to figure out how to integrate, like, food into, like, science and if there was a way that you could really study the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so plants came up.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, interesting. So plants, it's a really direct way, you know, agriculture is a really direct way where if you are able to kind of grow more, maybe crop, like, disease resistant crops, mm-hmm. or heat tolerant crops,
mm-hmm.
that could really, you know, have an impact on how farmers grow and, like, how food is being produced in different parts of the world. You know, it's a very, like, ever present thing in everyone's lives, you know?
Okay. So you said, like, plants came up. Food's king in your world, as it is in mine. So which plant food was your first focus?
Yeah, it still is my focus now. But basically, we study Arabidopsis thaliana. It's this little weed, and it's in the same family as a lot of different cabbages.
Okay.
So it's in the same family as like cabbage and broccoli. It's in the Brassicaceae family.
Okay.
And part of the reason why we study Arabidopsis is because the genetics, in terms of like if you really want to try to like tweak a lot of things of the genetics of Arabidopsis, mm-hmm. it's like a lot simpler. And
okay.
people have developed all of these protocols for you to be able to do and manipulate its genetics in the lab.
Okay.
And it grows everywhere. It's like a really weedy plant. Uh-huh. It grows on like in between like the cracks of sidewalks.
Oh, I heard that a weed is just a plant in the wrong place.
Yeah. Well, this one also grows like plant in the wrong place, and also just for some reason, it's really hard to kill.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like the mother of millions.
Yeah, exactly.
So is it considered invasive, or is it just like free food?
It's kind of, I don't know if people actually eat it as a, I don't know if actually people eat it.
Oh, okay.
But invasive is also kind of a tricky word, but I guess you could say that. It grows, it has a natural range in like Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's kind of like growing everywhere. They're like,
but it's not choking out other things. Is
nah.
It? Okay, then. So, if it's not something that people eat, then you're really looking at it for the simplicity of its DNA structure.
Yeah. So I can tell you a little bit about the pipeline of why like people would study something super simple.
Okay.
But the entire idea is that like because the really like functional regions of DNA,
mm-hmm.
they end up being conserved across many different plants. So something that you find in Arabidopsis uh-huh. could potentially also be relevant in like a
broccoli.
Crop species. Yeah, broccoli,
oh,
maize.
Okay.
And because you're working with something that's so simple that people have kind of like have developed so many different types of resources for,
mm-hmm.
it ends up being that, like, the thing that you end up being able to focus on are, like, more, like, scientific questions. So people end up trying to study, like, drought tolerance in
okay.
Arabidopsis plants
mm-hmm.
and then using that information that they learn in Arabidopsis to translate it to, like, corn.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at the DNA of plants
mm-hmm.
and you're thinking about, oh, we can tweak this, we can improve its drought tolerance, how is that considered genetically modified?
Yeah, to some degree. So I think genetically modified like foods mm-hmm. are usually things where it's like when you're introducing I think a foreign DNA
okay.
into like the plant.
Okay.
So it could be that like you found bacteria resistance in like a different species and you try to like put
jellyfish
it in.
And okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then this is more like when you're I don't know what you call it when you take a plant and you sort of you do something. And so, like, for example, Brussels sprouts are
yeah.
now less bitter because they've done something. I don't know what you call that process.
Yeah.
Do you know what they call that process?
So one way that you can kind of, like, almost – I guess, like, engineer traits that you could be interested in. So,
uh-huh.
like, drought tolerance, for example.
Yeah.
Could be just by doing what, honestly, farmers have been doing for years. It's, like, just, I think it's just called breeding, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just called plant breeding.
Oh, okay.
And then, traditionally, what you would do is you would grow these plants, see if they exhibit some type of drought tolerance,
mm-hmm.
and then try to use the seeds
okay.
and then propagate it into like a next
okay.
generation.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And is that what you guys are doing? You're sort of just trying to take the most drought-resistant seeds and breed them to get better crop tolerance?
Yeah, that's kind of the goal. We're trying to like figure out what are the genetic regions that are mm-hmm. important for drought tolerance, for example.
Okay.
But in a way that kind of makes plant breeding a little quicker, just
okay.
because if you can imagine if every single generation you're just growing plants, there's some plants that take like maybe, you know, a whole year before you're able to see like the trait of interest, it ends up like taking a really long time for you to really get to drought tolerance.
Okay.
And so we're trying to basically computationally like learn which genetic loci are important for a specific trait of interest with the hope that you can also do plant breeding, but like at a faster pace.
Now, has there been any indication that these regions that you're looking at, that you actually can port that knowledge to the other, just like the broccoli cabbage family, or are you still in the discovery process?
Ooh, yeah. So there have been many instances where this has occurred, which has been really cool. So one of the things that Arabidopsis has been super foundational for is in learning about heat stress.
Okay.
So when you stress out crops, they end up reducing their yields. They don't really, you know, grow as well. And so we've been able to basically learn a lot more about like the heat stress pathway. So like what are the genes that are involved in kind of heat stress? And it turns out this pathway is fairly conserved. And there have been cases where you can identify a gene that is important in Arabidopsis and knock it out in rice, for example.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's been cool to see that, you know, translational work being done.
Now, as you know, with coding, there are times when making a slight change after something's been built can have this sort of domino effect, and you have to go back to the drawing board. So how do you know that making those tweaks in that particular region won't have some sort of unintended domino effect?
Yeah, totally.
Because everything is so delicately balanced in nature, it seems that one little thing throws it all off.
Oh, 100%. So one thing you can do, I think, to just ensure that like what you're doing isn't going to be, you know, detrimental to the plant is so people have started doing a lot of field trials. So something that you find computationally, you can then try to test out experimentally by actually like, you know, maybe editing that entire gene out or like deleting that entire portion that you think is important. And then with those seeds, you can grow them in the field and see if they actually perform well. Because it could be that maybe you're thinking about trying to get drought tolerant seeds, but then as a result of optimizing for drought tolerance, you end up reducing like the yield of the plant, which is also not that great for farmers, right? You kind of want to optimize multiple things at once so that at the end of the day, the farmers are still going to be able to get a good income.
Okay.
So the only way really is to test it out in the world. And then in terms of like long-term consequences, I think that's something that we're still really trying to figure out. Like if you start engineering, you know, crops in this really specific way or doing like, you know, targeted plant breeding, are you then, you know, introducing some detrimental costs in the long term? And we kind of just have to wait and see.
Have there been any in other plant-related research, have there been any instances where they're like, oh, we did this, and here was this unintended consequence that we did not anticipate?
Yeah. So I think studies of that are coming out now. So one of the ones that I can think of is I think when they were trying to engineer, I think, BT resistance into maize.
What's BT resistance?
Or into corn, sorry. But BT resistance is basically, it's a bacteria that causes disease in corn.
Okay.
And so they were trying to basically have corn that wouldn't be susceptible to to this disease anymore so that it doesn't impact yield. And recently, I think there was a paper that where they found that so one kind of consequence of being able to grow, you know, these disease-resistant crops is that you can now increase the density in which you're growing these crops.
More plants per square foot.
Exactly. Because you know that the disease is not going to spread anymore because they're all resistant, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And I think what they've been finding is, like, over time, if you continuously do this, it actually causes a decrease in, like, disease resistance.
Really?
Yeah. So
do they know why that does happen? So does it make it even more disease resistant than before it was introduced? Is it a Flowers for Algernon situation?
Yeah. So to some degree, I think what ended up happening was because now corn is now resistant to this one particular like disease. Now you're almost like causing this like shift where other diseases.
They're like, now's our chance.
I know. Yeah. And then so now they're like adapting. A lot of these diseases are like, interesting. Now we don't have to compete with, you know, this one type anymore. And that was something that I think there's still studies that are coming out because this is you kind of almost have to look across like a really large like time frame for you to understand like consequences. But sure. But it's crazy to think about, like, yeah, 5-10 years down the road, like, what's actually going to happen when we, you know, introduce these crops into the wild.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's touching your mind right now? Christy Mualem is talking about science and talking about plants. Tell me, in your research and what you're doing, what's one of the things that you discover that, I mean, because you talked about being able to look in a microscope and that blew your mind, but what's something in your current field that blew your mind that you were just like, wow, I want everyone to know this, or I didn't know this was going on, this is amazing?
Yo, yeah, that's a great question. So I think one thing that was super new to me was even this idea of like genetic diversity. And it's kind of this idea of like, so far, the way that we've been growing plants has just been like using one specific like variety and then growing it continuously. And then what we're seeing is that, so one example could be like bananas, right? Bananas are all kind of clones of each other. I think there was maybe like a news article that it came out that if there was a disease that could kill off this specific like variety, we might not have bananas anymore, mainly because they were all the same.
So same with zebras. There's like,
oh, really?
All, they all sort of they share a. There's no diversity within the zebra population.
That's crazy.
I know.
Oh, that's really cool. Sad for the zebras, but very, very
right,
cool.
Right. Yeah, but that whole thing of like one thing could come along and boop, no more bananas, no more banana bread.
Yo, yeah. So then basically this idea of genetic diversity is like you have to include, you know, different types and variation in terms of like the genetics of a plant when you grow things so that if a disease came along, it wouldn't wipe out the entire plot. And that really like blew my mind, just this idea of changing the way that we're like growing food.
Right. But that's most agribusinesses and even small farmers, they specialize in single crops.
Yeah.
There's very little diversity. What kind of response would someone get from saying, hey, you know, you're at risk from losing your entire crop if you don't diversify? And they're like, we're fine so far.
Yeah. So it's tricky. This is a really tricky topic, mainly because I think farmers don't even really profit that much.
Right. They're basically land slaves.
Yeah, essentially, which is crazy because these are the people that are growing our
food.
Yeah. So, like, there was a study that found that actually farmers are the most food insecure. And
Really?
Isn't that insane?
Because they're producing food for everybody else, and they don't have any leftover. You know, they're producing that one crop, and they don't have much for themselves.
Yeah. So I thought it was to do with proximity. Like, if you're, you know, proximately close to like food, then maybe you would get.
Yeah,
you get like food security. But at the end of the day, it's like they don't profit enough from what they're doing. That it's just they don't have money to
and
buy
see,
food.
That's crazy because if the farmers go out of business, there's no food for us. It's like. I'm a city girl. I don't know. I don't know anything. Things stay alive in spite of me, not because of me. So
yeah,
it's crazy.
So it's kind of insane. But then the system that we have of growing just a single type of variety has become really efficient. We are able to produce so much corn and so much more, wheat mm-hmm. in this type of system than we can in a system where you actually do diversify things. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky mainly because it's hard to or maybe it's also kind of unfair to ask a farmer to then change the way that they're doing things mm-hmm. without really any, safeguard as to whether when you make this change, are you actually going to, see an increase in your income or still get the same income.
Yeah.
So because there's so many, factors at stake, that their livelihoods are at stake, I think it ends up being a very tricky topic. So that's, yeah.
Well, then let's talk about a different tricky topic. when you're in the lab, what responsibilities do you have in terms of what your research is?
Yeah. I think it's nice because I get a lot of freedom in terms mm-hmm. of what I decide I want to work on. So
what's a typical day for you look like in terms of the plant world?
Yeah. I will say I'm a computational scientist, so a lot of what I do is just looking at the terminal. But I have started growing, a whole flat of Arabidopsis plants, for example. And that's really opened up my mind because... Okay. Like you, I'm also a city girl,
uh-huh.
and I should get my hands dirty. As a plant scientist, I should be growing plants and knowing where food comes from mm-hmm. and understanding the labor that comes with growing plants.
And also the language of the plants, because there's what it says in the books, and then there's what the plants actually do. This doesn't match
You're like, why are you not doing what it says it was supposed to do?
Maybe I'll just look at the plant, not the book, and ask people who actually work with it. So when you do you're the computational person, so what kinds of data are you getting, and how do you interpret that data?
Yeah, so a lot of what we use is genetic data. Mm-hmm. So it's just things from so basically for every single individual of a single species, we can actually get the genetic makeup of that plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes we also use phenotypic data. So
what's phenotype?
Yeah,
what's a phenotype?
So a phenotype could be anything that is observable. So for example, one could be how many seeds does a plant produce?
Okay.
Or
And that's what a phenotype is? Is mm-hmm. something observable?
Something observable, oh, okay. Yeah.
That's an awfully fancy word for such a simple concept.
I know. We really need to figure out a way to make a lot of these words way simpler. Because I think barrier to entry,
you thought, people are born scientists. It's like, oh no, they just use fancier words.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's really just a way to make things sound way more complicated and more smart for no apparent reason.
So you take this DNA. What are you getting? My understanding of the DNA is just strands of letters, and I'm guessing that the Arabidopsis is a finite amount of letters.
Yeah.
So how long is that DNA chain? Is it millions or thousands or 10?
Yeah, I think it's – so Arabidopsis is actually on the smaller end of genome size, which is really nice. So it's at 135 megabases.
I don't know what a megabase is.
So a megabase is, I think, a million.
Wait, so there's 135 times a million letters?
Yes.
And that's small?
That's considered small.
Wow.
Yeah. I think humans are
a bajillion?
We're huge. It's crazy.
Okay.
We're huge.
But even still, on that scale, how do you parse something that's so big?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Yeah. So a lot of what we end up being interested in when we look at like genetic data is just like differences across individuals.
Okay.
Because that those differences in kind of this like string of sequences that or string of like, I guess,
AG, blah, blah,
you know. Yeah, string of letters that uh-huh. you're really interested in are like, what are the differences that are causing the differences in like what we observe?
So are you taking individual differences within that particular weed, or is it the difference between this weed and the broccoli and the, so is, which one is it?
So you could do both. So I actually do both. So okay. And it just depends on the question that you're interested. So okay. One of the cool things about Arabidopsis is that it can grow in different environments and climates. And so one thing that you can, you know, ask is, what are the genetic differences that end up causing an Arabidopsis to be able to grow in like a hot climate mm-hmm. as opposed to like a cold climate?
Oh, okay. So you take their DNA strands and you like stack them up and go, oh, here's where these mm-hmm. letters changed.
But yeah.
Still, but so you need a computer to do that because a human can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. You need like algorithms to be able to basically, one, align the sequences,
uh-huh.
And then two, pick out the differences.
Okay.
And then with those differences, you can now, you know, basically like hopefully, and what we've done is just like drawn conclusions on maybe this one specific difference is uh-huh. causing like a difference in the way that Arabidopsis like grows in different climates.
Oh, okay. So do you, would you say take Arabidopsis from, say, Alaska? You take a bunch of different samples of that and then take some that you found in, like, New Mexico and then compare, first you would compare all of the Alaska ones and go, these are pretty similar. And then do you find that, oh, we take Arabidopsis from all these different places, but within the same climate, they are similar? Or are you finding that it changes even within the climate?
Yeah. So for the most part, what we see are like differences when you change climate.
Okay.
Which makes sense because it's like when you're changing, like temperature is such a, you know, plants are so sensitive to mm-hmm. temperature, yes. right? So that like differences could cause, you know, differences in yield.
Okay.
And so that ends up being what we see is that like climatic differences or just differences in temperature seem to be like, yeah, seem to be the thing that is being defined by like these genetic regions.
And are the genetic regions the same depending on like if we're just going to look in this column and this is where all of the hot versus cold stuff is happening on the DNA strand?
So they're like everywhere.
Oh, so that's, up and down the chain?
Yeah, they could be up and down the chain. They could be like the crazy thing about individuals is also that maybe a region that seems to be important for like some type of tolerance mm-hmm. could be located in like maybe like this particular region could be located in a different site. A different individual. So it ends up being kind of this tricky thing of trying to figure out, am I comparing the right things?
Oh, that's tricky because you don't know if it's redundancy for safety
mm-hmm.
or if you need both of them in the same place for it to occur.
Yeah.
So how do you figure that out? Or have you figured it out?
So I think this ends up being kind of an open question.
Oh, okay.
We're still really trying to figure out what is the best way to like, you know, align all these like sequences so that we can get a better understanding of are we looking at similar sites.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of people have been using or developing a lot of these machine learning algorithms to try to do this very fancy, you know, comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And there's success to varying degrees.
Sure.
And part of it is also because like plant genomes are crazy. The amount of diversity that exists in plants are, you know, insane. Mm-hmm. Humans have really only, when you look at kind of like human genetics, we're actually, you know, not a very diverse population,
right.
like
we're all
genetically.
Shaped pretty much the same.
Yeah, we're really, really similar to each other. Yeah. Like
two eyes, a nose. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. We actually are like, in terms of like, you know, genetics, we're like, I think there was a statistic that said we're like 99.9% similar to like mm-hmm. the next individual that you see on the street, which is not true for plants. They could be really different.
Right. You have like your horn-shaped plants, and you have your succulents. You have this vast array of differences. You don't see, you know, people aren't plants. They're just, you know, various hues of the same output.
Stamp
the mold. That's crazy, though. So when you are looking at these regions that are in multiple places,
mm-hmm.
do you do a systematic thing where you have one set where you remove both of them, one set where you just remove this one, just remove that one, and what kind of yields do you get from that?
Yeah. So this is also kind of like another line of research of like how much redundancy exists in like a plant genome, uh-huh. and can you kind of manipulate how many copies of one thing you have as opposed to like another? In terms of yield, I think it's really still an open question, but the in terms of like being able to increase the number of copies,
mm-hmm.
It turns out that plants are really tolerant to this. Like you can basically produce like different, you know, different a lot of copies of this one region that you're interested in,
mm-hmm.
and it will still be able to reproduce. It will still be able to survive, and maybe it increases like a very specific trait. I haven't seen anything in relation to yield yet,
mm-hmm.
but it would be kind of an interesting line of research to see if just by increasing the number of copies of one site, maybe you could really see increases in yield. And that would be a really cool finding in itself.
Now, are there farmers that are actually interested in the research that's coming out about this type of diversity? And if so, where are they? Where are those farmers in the world who are like chomping at the bit to hear what you guys have to say?
Yo, yeah. So I recently learned that actually there are universities in Florida that have been thinking about how do you do, you know, smarter plant breeding. So mm-hmm. how do you just like cut short the amount of time it takes for you to get from which, you know, genetic sequences are important for mm-hmm. yield
mm-hmm.
that traditionally might take 10 years. Could you cut it down into 1 year?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of universities at Florida and a lot of like the big, you know, ag companies like Monsanto and Bayer. And mm-hmm. I guess Bayer is also part of Monsanto, or like Driscoll's. They're all really interested in this idea of like, how do you accelerate the way in which we are able to, yeah, enhance specific traits, mm-hmm. Like yield.
But they're tricky companies, and you know, because a lot of their stuff is banned abroad. And,
yeah,
you know, they're tricky. Let's say,
yeah,
but like from the rank and file farmer who. Well, let me ask you this. Do you guys mm-hmm. get input from people who actually do farming? Because, again, there's what you kind of know academically, but then
yeah.
there's the reality of the people who work with something all the time and they understand the subtleties of it. So do you have that input from farmers?
Yeah. What you're pointing at is honestly a really important, like, avenue. So we haven't really engaged farmers mainly because a lot of our work is like, it's, I guess, what you would term like basic science.
Okay.
So we do a lot more work just related to like understanding the genetics of plants.
Okay.
With the hope that once you understand the genetics of plants, maybe this will help accelerate, you know, specific like gene discoveries for, you know, enhanced traits.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're pointing at is like a really important thing where farmers do actually have all of this knowledge that, you know, when we think about genetics and maybe we just have the terms to like describe what's happening,
mm-hmm.
farmers actually see this on the ground. You know, they're able to just grab a handful of soil and mm-hmm. tell you this, you know, this doesn't feel right. This is a lot drier.
Right.
They can observe it with their eyes. They can describe a lot of these things to you mm-hmm. that maybe we describe in very, very different ways, right? We're just really giving them an explanation as mm-hmm. to why they see certain things. And I think that ends up being the goal that, or, you know, the end goal of what I want to do with a lot of this work.
Mm-hmm.
So my motivation is when I, you know, brought up that my family was from Indonesia, I think one of the goals is when I finish the PhD, I really want to go back to Indonesia and see if anything that I've learned in terms of, you know, the genetics mm-hmm. can help, like, on-the-ground farmers explain what they're seeing with okay. the hopes that, you know, they could see something visually and tell you this crop isn't doing well for some reason this mm-hmm. year because it's been too hot.
I have a question about that because
yeah.
you're from Indonesia. I was in Singapore once. It was Ooh. Wildly hot. The food was delicious. It was
yeah.
wildly hot, though. And that was like 10 years ago. And it seems like all of these places that are hot that, you know, the people who live there have gotten accustomed to that temperature that's been steady for hundreds, if not thousands of years. But now the temperatures are inching up. So what do you know about how climate change is affecting Indonesia?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I think these are the places that are going to be and are already really seeing the effects of climate change. Mm-hmm. Mainly because of what you said, like these places are already
very hot.
So hot. And so like really any incremental increase in temperatures is not only really affecting plants, but also affecting people, mm-hmm. right? There are like all these studies where if you're just exposed to so much heat, your productivity goes down, like the safety in terms of like driving also goes mm-hmm. down, mainly because I don't think like people are meant to, you know,
live in 110 degrees.
Yeah, it turns out.
So do you hear about it, or is it more that you just know about it, but people aren't really talking about it yet?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what I see is also just visually, but then also anecdotal. So mm-hmm. My family actually owns a rubber processing firm.
Okay.
And something that is a concern is, will rubber plants be able to, you know, grow in like an increased climate, for example? Mm-hmm. And a lot of studies have shown that as temperatures increase, there's also going to be a higher likelihood of disease.
Right.
And so it kind of, I think, affects me personally to that degree. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rubber isn't something that we eat, but then...
Right, but it's you know, emblematic of a larger change. I also saw studies where as the temperatures increase, species that couldn't thrive, you know, like invasive species
yeah.
of insects and bacteria could now move further north because and flourish,
yeah.
whereas before there was a weather barrier that kept them at bay. And so they start seeing bacterias that they never
yeah.
saw before, you know, in like Minnesota.
Yeah, that's also a huge concern because then when you're introducing new bacteria into a place, the plants don't even have, they haven't built up like,
right.
you know, the resistance. Mechanisms to resist to these things. And so that ends up being like yet another problem.
Mm-hmm.
But with all that being said, I think there are a lot of like very intelligent people that are working on this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really cool things that I read about was Indonesia doesn't, you know, it has a lot of money going into research, not at the scale of the U.S., but one of the things that they've been working on is different rice varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So can you basically engineer like increased for your rice to basically have like more vitamins, for example.
Okay.
So that this is going to help curb nutrient deficiencies.
Oh, okay.
Or can you grow rice that are flood tolerant so that even if you have increased, you know, rains, because with climate change, these weather patterns are going to be so much more unpredictable. Can you then grow strains that are going to be a little bit more tolerant to that so that farmers can still have yield? And a lot of this research is coming out of, you know, countries that you wouldn't traditionally think of,
mm-hmm.
Mainly because it's such a big concern. Like Indonesians love eating rice, you know, so this is like our staple crop.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also a really cool shift that I'm seeing, that maybe we don't have all of the solutions in the West, and the countries that are underground that are experiencing all of this, maybe they're going to be the ones that mm-hmm. we need to look to them to see what are the creative ways in which they're trying to adapt. Because a lot of this work needs to be local.
Sure.
And yeah.
Yeah. So when you are working, what's one of your favorite things that you enjoy doing in the lab or I don't know, wherever you do it? What's one of the favorite things? You're like, oh, I'm really looking forward to this thing.
Yeah. Okay, I get that feeling when I am able to like debug my code. But that's a very personal thing.
But debugging can be frustrating.
But then you get the little bits of, happiness when you like, when you figure out
the
that
islands of happiness.
Exactly.
In a sea of grief.
It's temporary, but I latch onto that. So uh-huh. I'm like, every single time I feel that, I'm like, all right, I think I'm done for the day. Even mm-hmm. if what I solved was just like this really small thing.
Okay.
But then another thing that now I'm actually discovering is as I'm growing my plants mm-hmm. and like subjecting them to different types of stress, mm-hmm. these plants get weird.
Ooh.
Yeah. Sometimes like it's crazy because even in Arabidopsis, and you would traditionally think a plant needed to just be green.
Mm-hmm.
They somehow like adopt different colorations. So,
really?
Yeah. So we've seen Arabidopsis plants that are like purple or have hues of pink or
wow.
Yeah, it's kind of insane.
And do their seeds produce purple and pink babies?
Well, the seeds do. But the seed color themselves are not like they don't change. But
no,
then
but
when they grow up.
Yeah. So once they start expressing themselves in this different color, then like all of their kids or a number of their kids, because, genetics.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Isn't that insane?
So then do you have names for them when they start going? Because I would naming everything.
I think
like, this is purple haze.
Yo, that would be crazy. Okay, so with these plants, I think once you name something, you just get way too attached to them.
True.
And then you
feel bad eating them or chopping them.
So that's the thing. But I do have friends who like work with like frogs, and mm-hmm. She'll basically name every single one of her frogs
and then kill them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I think is brutal.
Yes.
No, but I get it. You work with something so intimately that it ends up like having its own like little personality. And
right. But you're making these plants, and then they have. It's like you're making your own cultivars that you could, because plant people love cultivars and offshoots of things.
Yo, yes, they do, especially with plants, because you could do grafting too. You could just like. Join two things that mm-hmm. wouldn't traditionally be like, combined together and create like something completely different. I know people in like who grow roses
mm-hmm.
do this a lot, and they have a name for every single variety that comes up, which I think is cool. And just like looking at like the variation that could exist is insane. It's like really taking me out of like this box of what I think plants could be,
mm-hmm.
Which is... I don't know. I'm always like super fascinated whenever I think now I have a new appreciation of like walking around San Francisco mm-hmm. and looking at the different plants and the flowers and how many forms they can take.
Mm-hmm. Some are fuzzy and,
Yeah, it's insane. Especially when like it hasn't rained in a while and you can still see little plants like trying mm-hmm. to like, survive. They're like, ah.
And on that note... I love this. For our listening audience, if you were to recommend a book or a website about plants and what you're studying that's accessible, what would you recommend?
Ooh. Yeah, it's a...
Or if they could just look at your... is there a place where they can read what your lab is doing?
Yeah. So our lab website is moilab.science.
.science?
.science.
Wow. I like that. Today I learned that there's a .science.
I know. It's a really cool extension.
Excellent.
But there's also a lot of books that's like The Future of Food, or like like food to table, like how do you, you know, grow a more or like have a more sustainable agricultural system, and all of those things. I think really the main thing is just if you ever get a chance to have your hand at growing plants or growing your own food, that's mm-hmm. really the best way to, like, you know, rekindle this connection that we've lost with being able to grow something in our backyard.
Excellent. Well, Christy, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for explaining things in a way that I could understand them.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you.
Okay, people of Earth, plants, science, it's all great. It's all wonderful. I love having scientists on. It makes up for my pitiful science education. You know what's not pitiful? Mr. Ford is going to be pleasuring your ear hole in just a few minutes. I'm going to leave you, because she inspired me, I'm going to leave you with some Jimi Hendrix. This, my friend, Long Hot Summer Night.
My heart was way down.